And good morning, and welcome to Word of Mouth, the program where captivating people talk about their unique jobs. I'm your host, Jim Wunderlich, and today I'll be chatting with Dr. Brian Medley, Director of Internal Medicine and a hospitalist for best practice inpatient care. Now, Doctor, the last time we talked, it was under completely different conditions. I was in the hospital, and you were my amazing attending physician. I like these conditions a lot more. Thanks for being here.
Well, thanks, Jim. It's good to see you again, although I miss seeing you in your very cute and lovely hospital gown. Sometimes I don't always recognize patients when I see them when they have good hygiene.
Didn't even know I had a shirt, huh?
Yeah.
Well, hey, it is great to see you, and we had a chance to talk a little bit in the hospital from what I remember, but... You know, I don't think I ever asked you, at what point did you know, I want to be a doctor? This is what I want to do. I want to be a physician.
Well, great question, Jim. I knew, luckily, from a very young age that I wanted to be a physician. Start out by saying my mom was a registered nurse from the time I was five on until adolescence. So I was exposed to the medical field at a young age. But I would say the point in my life when I decided that I wanted to be some type of a physician is when my best friend's mother passed away when I was a sophomore in high school. Her name was Robin Ratliff, and she had a familial form of or inherited form of pancreatitis where the pancreas was inflamed over and over and over. And unfortunately, it led to a various shutdown of her body systems, and she died at a very young age in her early 30s. And that really spoke to me as to we need more doctors in the field doing research and working very hard to deal with some of these inherited disorders. So that was the moment when I knew that I was going to be a physician.
You know, I want to back up a little bit, though. You did teach chemistry at Ohio State before becoming a doctor then?
That's correct, yeah.
Okay, so you took a little bit of a detour there. What happened exactly there?
Well, while I was waiting to get into medical school, I also thought I might do some type of research for inherited disorders of metabolism, which are more rare disorders you wouldn't have likely heard of. Mm-hmm. So I excelled at biochemistry in college and thought I might be a biochemist and work on new pharmaceuticals for rare diseases. And in fact, once I got into medical school, I actually had my own website for about a year that dealt with inherited disease of metabolism on the inside of your body. And in fact, I even had contact with moms and dads who had young kids who had these, some of them just awful inherited diseases, and it really meant a lot to me. And sometimes I still think about that particular field.
Well, I guess as a doctor, you're always doing research, though. That never really stops.
Correct.
Right. After that, then you went to the University of Massachusetts for your residency. What was that experience a lot? All I know is from what I see in the TV shows.
For sure. Okay. Well, let me talk a little bit more about the chemistry teaching.
Sure, absolutely.
And then I'll talk more about the residency. I have a lot to say about residency, but while I was teaching, I was only 22 at the time.
Oh, my goodness.
And I was teaching, I just had graduated from college, and so I was taking some classes in basic EKG reading and blood drawing to try to beef up my resume. To get into medical school or become a biochemist for a pharmaceutical company. While I was there, the dean of the school came in and said, we really could use a chemistry teacher.
So that's how it happened then?
That's how it happened, yeah.
That was not really in the plan. It just was serendipity, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely accidental. But what was really striking about it was I taught two classes, one with about 40 students and one with about 25. And this was an unconventional nursing program, so these were students who had already been out of high school for a while. And it turned out that out of the 63 students that I had, I was the youngest person in both classrooms.
How did they react to that?
Yeah. I mean, most of them were reasonably close to my age, but there were a few. And in fact, there was one very nice lady who came up after my first lecture, and she said, doctor, she called me doctor. She said, I'm 63 years old. She said, I'm old enough to be your grandmother.
Oh, that's terrific. So how long were you at Ohio State then?
A couple of semesters.
Okay, a few semesters. And then you went to the, then you would have gone to medical school.
Right, I was accepted to medical school that coming fall. So I enrolled in the fall of 98 in Kentucky is where I went to medical school.
Okay.
So I kind of moved around a little bit. My parents told me there was more to life than Ohio, where I was born and raised.
And then you got to the University of Massachusetts, and that's where you did your residency. And I always find, a lot of these medical shows spend a lot of time on that. What was it like being a resident? What do you remember
what do you recall being a resident?
Being very tired.
So it is these 36-hour type of stretches, that type of thing.
Yes, definitely.
That's definitely true then. Okay.
Definitely they try to break you to see if you can withstand not only the physical but also the mental, being mentally fatigued but also being on the top of your game, going on little or sometimes no sleep at all.
You know, in a way, that kind of is the opposite of what good health is all about, too, isn't it?
Very much the opposite, yes, exactly.
So you had some interesting experiences, I'm sure, while a resident. Want to share a few of those?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, I think I would start with a more tame experience I had when I was first learning to sew patients up, which is always one of the first things you learn to do when you're first working in the emergency room. You're sort of judged by how well can you sew, you know, because you don't want to leave a really bad scar on somebody. So
before you do a live person, I have a question, though. Do you work on cadavers to get to the point where you can work on a live person?
Of course. Okay. In medical school, yes, we had cadavers in medical school where we learned how to sew. We also were given pig skin and cloth so we could be on different types of skin, learning how to tie. There are multiple ways you can tie a knot. You can use a needle. You can use your hands to tie knots with. And by the time you become a resident, you should know how to tie knots and make a suture line look good so the person can still go to the beach.
But still, when you have a breathing, live person, the first time you do that has to be a little, I would think, nerve-wracking.
It is a bit nerve-wracking, but you learn how not to show that it's the first time.
Acting.
You know you walk in with a great deal of swagger and confidence. Yes, this is the 1 billionth time I've sewed people up, even though it was the first one. But I was very fortunate that my first patient was a drunk who stumbled and fell and had split his leg open.
Oh, my goodness.
A good portion of his leg open, actually. But he was quite intoxicated and passed out. So my teacher said, well, I want you to sew this guy up. That should be worth 30 to 40 stitches easy. By the time you're done, you should be a pro. And I said, okay. So I went to grab the materials I needed, which included lidocaine, which is an injectable anesthetic.
Right.
So they don't feel you, you know, sewing them back up. And my mentor said, what are you doing? He's drunk. He's passed out. You don't need lidocaine. Just do it. And he pushed me into the room. And I sewed this gentleman up the whole time praying that he would not wake up.
So you just dived right into the deep end, so to speak. Really.
I sure did. And what was funny about it is my mentor didn't even come into the room until after I was done.
Now, your residency is 4 years long. You did that from 2003 to 2007? Am I off on that?
Well, it was 4 years. Most internal medicine residencies, which is general medicine ages 18 and up, is 3 years.
Okay.
But my residency approached me and asked me to stay another year to do what's called a chief medical resident year, where you teach discipline, schedule.
Oh, okay. So a little bit of administrative work, too, then.
Yeah, I did an entire year of administrative work before taking the position I'm at now.
So you worked there, and then anything else, any other stories you have about being a resident?
Oh, yes, yeah, definitely. Yeah, I have one that's a little less tame that I can share with
you. Yeah, absolutely, please.
So I was an intern, of course, and when you're an intern, that means you're right out of medical school. You have your medical degree, but you have no practical experience yet. And you're often asked to do things for the first time, and you've never done them before, and sometimes with or without adequate supervision. And, you know, you're a teaching doctor, sometimes available only by phone.
Okay.
Although you do have more senior residents that are floating around that can periodically come in and help you. So one night, I was spending the night in the hospital, and I got called about a patient I didn't know. And it was a very unusual case. It was a gentleman who was in the process of a sex change.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. And I don't recall his name. We'll just call him Alice, for lack of a better word.
I have to ask, he was in the process
of becoming a woman.
Not to be too graphic, but what does that exactly mean?
Well, they usually remove the genitalia. They inject hormones to make the person look more female.
Because it's a very gradual process.
It is.
Understand.
It is.
Right,
yeah,
right.
It's not an overnight thing. So right. He was in the process. But the unfortunate part for this person was they happened to get cancer. Mm. And that was how they wound up in the hospital.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, the on-call cancer doctor called me, of course, at an ungodly hour at 1 o'clock in the morning and said, this person's cancer is relatively acute and we need to begin chemotherapy, you know, relatively soon, like now.
Oh, wow.
So I said, okay. I said, well, what is it you need me to do? He said, well, I need you to put a central line, which is a large catheter, in his groin so we can give fluids and antibiotics and so on and support him while he's getting chemotherapy. So this was 1 o'clock in the morning. I'm going in to see a patient I've never met before who's in the midst of a sex change but also has cancer. You can't make this kind of thing up.
No, you can't.
Yeah. So I went in, and of course, I usually, when I'm in situations like this, I usually take at least one nurse with me. I took two nurses with me in to see this patient. And I had to get him ready to put the line in his groin. Well, he still had his male anatomy, which made it a little difficult because I needed to get access to the groin.
I have no questions.
Yeah.
This is the first time ever.
Speechless for the first time.
The first time, yeah.
So
wow.
With
very difficult procedure, to say the least.
Oh, absolutely,
yeah,
absolutely,
yeah.
Because you want to make sure you get into the vein and not into the artery.
Very stressful, yeah.
The artery could be life-threatening if you hit the artery. In fact, I've met people who've lost legs, toes, because they accidentally hit arteries when they were trying to get into a vein. So I have to make sure I know my anatomy, I know where I'm at, I know where the needle's going.
So it's tricky, yeah.
And it's 1 o'clock in the morning, and I'm dealing with a patient who's in the midst of a sex change, but also who has cancer, so it's a relatively tense situation. But the humor, and the patient actually laughed when I said this, as did the nurses, so there was some comic relief at 1:30 in the morning, was I needed him to move his anatomy, but he had a female name.
Oh.
So I said, ma'am, I need you to move your penis out of the way.
And he had a sense of humor.
He had a sense of humor. That lightened up the mood, and the line went right into the vein, and I sewed it down, and then that.
And that's what counts. And it sounds like procedures like that is what just builds more confidence for you as a doctor anyway. It's, in a way, you've kind of seen it all, so to speak.
Oh, absolutely. I feel like I can do anything now.
You know, I noticed that you are a DO versus an MD.
That's right.
And I'm just curious about that. What does that mean exactly?
Sure. Well, the DO is defined as either a doctor of osteopathy or a doctor of osteopathic medicine. They're synonymous with each other. It just depends on how the medical school wants to award the degree. But a doctor of osteopathic medicine is, we essentially have the same basic science training as an MD, but we have a little extra coursework, and primarily in medical school, that deals with gentle manipulative techniques. Much like a chiropractor. But we're not using a lot of the high velocity, you know, rack 'em and crack 'em, so to speak. You know, we're using a lot of gentle techniques to overcome tendonitis or various forms of arthritis, stiff muscles.
What kind of techniques would you use exactly if I have tendonitis? What would you...
Sure. Muscle energy, myofascial release.
But what is muscle energy? What do you mean exactly?
Yeah, muscle energy is where, rather than... forcing something into the barrier, you, like, for example, if your arm won't turn inwards, I wish I could show this a little bit better, you actually take it away from the barrier, so it's an indirect technique.
So I see that you're manipulating with your thumb.
Right, with my arm,
Is it that your wrist you're doing? Or is
I
that
am,
the,
yes. Okay, yeah. So okay. If your problem is at your elbow and you can't turn your hand in, you gradually take it away from the way you can't do it, and you sort of stretch it out. I wish I could explain this better.
Well, it's a little bit like physical therapy.
It is. It is a bit like physical therapy, but we also are taught the high velocity, the crack the neck, crack the back.
Oh, okay.
You know, we also
which
are
a medical doctor would not have.
Or a medical doctor would not be able to do that. But, you know, the other thing is it's more of a holistic approach. So rather than just focusing on, well, my shoulder hurts, well, how's your cholesterol? And how is the other parts of you? Because DOs believe that the body is interconnected, that if you have a problem, let's say, in your ankle, it could cause a problem all the way up in your back because of a compensation issue.
I mean, it is like there's a lot of PT here then, or physical therapy.
I guess you could say it is like physical therapy. What you try to do is you find the area of greatest restriction, or the AGR. So you try to find where is the person restricted most. Is it their ankle? Is it their wrist? Is it their neck? And once you fix the area of greatest restriction, the other ones usually just go away.
I think that's fascinating. So as a DO, I'm going to assume, and I may be answering your question for you, with the holistic approach, are more people who go into it more holistic? Is that really what attracts them to that part of medicine?
Partly, but also there's an attraction to being a family physician. Most DO schools and DO residencies push for them to become family practitioners. And I thought I might do that initially, as it was be a family practitioner. So in medical school, you get a bit more training in obstetrics and general surgery and emergency rooms. So if you're the only doctor for 100 miles... you can do minor surgeries, you can deliver babies,
right,
you're
right.
very multi-talented, and that's what really drew me to a DO school.
Okay. Now, you're also a hospitalist, which I don't think that term even existed 20 years ago.
You're right, it didn't.
Okay, so that's just evolved recently. What is it?
Sure. Well, the word hospitalist was coined in the mid-1990s, 94, 95.
Very recent.
Yeah, so if you look in, for example, the New England Journal of Medicine sometime in 94, 95, forget me, I don't remember the exact issue, there was a doctor out in San Francisco named Robert Wachter, who I've met a couple of times, and he was the first hospitalist or the first person to coin the term. And basically, a hospitalist is a hospital-based doctor. That's really what he is. He's usually trained and board-certified in internal medicine, which is what I am.
Mm-hmm.
Internal medicine is just general adult medicine, ages 18 and up.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to know you're sort of a jack-of-all-trades. You're trained in all of the different organ systems and so on. But your emphasis is more on hospitalized patients, which I enjoy. You know, I prefer the really sick people. I want to take care of the strokes and the heart attacks and the pneumonias. And that's what a hospital-based physician does, is hospital type of illnesses.
And then you're really on top of the situation where a family doctor might come in, what, the next day, or you're there on a regular basis, correct?
Right, right. So if you were being taken care of by your general practitioner or your general internist, what would happen is if you came in, let's say at midnight into the hospital, the emergency room would call and say, Mr. Wunderlich is here with this particular diagnosis. You want to admit him? Your primary care doctor would say, yes, I'll admit him. I'll be in the morning to see him around 6:30. He would see you. Then he would go to his office for the rest of the day and then come back around 6 or so to round on his new admissions that came in through the morning and the afternoon, maybe discharge you if you're fortunate enough to have gotten better. But there's, you know, obviously kind of a slowdown there. He's not there to expedite things. He's distracted by his office, and rightfully so.
Also, you can make more visits, I would assume, too, then. With the patient in the hospital is what I'm saying.
Oh, yes, definitely. Right. So where I come in at is the emergency room will call your doctor at midnight and say, Mr. Wunderlich is here. He'll say, well, I admit to Dr. Medley, who's my hospitalist, who's going to see and take care of my patient during the hospital stay and then discharge him right back to me.
Mm-hmm.
So I call your doctor at 7 a.m. whenever I get there, and I say, hey, doctor, I've got your patient, Mr. Wunderlich. He has this, this, and this. This is what I'm going to do. Is there anything I should know that you might know?
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything you want me to do, specifically any other doctors you want me to consult?
So there's a lot of coordination that has to go between the primary care doctor and yourself, I would think.
Absolutely. In fact, what I would say, Jim, is that care coordination is likely the most important aspect of being a hospitalist, not just being able to take charge of sick patients and manage medical problems, but coordinating with the other doctors, in particular the primary care, is the most important part of being a hospitalist.
At the same time, though, when I'm in the hospital or if a patient's in the hospital, you really are the captain of the ship when that person's in the hospital. I mean, it all goes through you, I assume.
That's correct. That's correct. So each patient, you probably had a wristband on you somewhere or stickers attached to your chart if you ever looked at your medical records and it says who's the attending physician. And that should have been either me or someone from my group, depending on who was on call when they called, you know, with an admission. So I'm the attending physician, and I take over as soon as they leave the emergency room and until you leave the hospital. And then the whole time, I'm in contact with your primary at admission, any significant updates along the way, and then at discharge. I also coordinate at the end to make sure that you follow up with your primary care doctor.
But in a way, once I'm released, unless you're on a radio show like today, I never see you again. And I would think that aspect of it, I was just thinking about that. I would maybe as a doctor, do you miss that at all? In other words, I'm gone after I've been in the hospital. And then the connection that maybe a primary care doctor has. I'm just asking, that's all.
Sure. Well, I would say, oddly enough, that's not really an issue for me because I have what are called a lot of frequent flyers, where I see a lot of the same patients over and over and over.
And I
get to know them sometimes on a first-name basis.
Sure,
and I even get to know their family. And the other thing is I have such a good relationship with a lot of my primaries that they actually will periodically call me and say, hey, this is what's going on with Mr. Wunderlich. And they'll give me an update and tell me what's going on, even outside of the hospital.
Is your care ever different than the primary care doctor? Can that happen? Has there been cases where the primary doctor might say, look, I want you to do this, and as the hospitalist, you're the captain of the ship, and you say, well, look, I'm here in the hospital, we're going to do this. Yeah. Do cases like that occur?
Very rarely.
Okay.
But yes, to answer your question, but very, very rarely, and it's usually based on information the primary knows that I don't have. And once he educates me about a particular aspect for a patient, then I will. I often will comply with the primary because we usually agree.
You know what? Very interesting. We're going to come back with more of Dr. Medley. We're going to take a short break. You're listening to Word of Mouth, and you've been listening also to Dr. Brian Medley, Doctor of Internal Medicine. And when we come back, we're going to get into situations where there's some tense families, tense situations that Dr. Medley's had to go through. So I sure hope you'll stick around right here on Word of Mouth. And music from The Fray. That, of course, is How to Save a Life, and the theme song from Grey's Anatomy. And it's a pleasure to have Dr. Brian Medley with us today. And, you know, Dr. Medley, that kind of segues to the fact that the TV shows that I see, the medical TV shows, do they at all reflect anything in your life that you see, that in your career?
Well, they meant a lot to me early on in my career, especially in college. The very popular hit show ER, which of course took place here in the Chicagoland area.
Right. Cook County Hospital.
Cook County Hospital, right. Meant a lot to me. I watched it every night. I even sacrificed my study nights to watch to watch that particular show. But, you know, I would say that they obviously glorify things a bit. And, you know, in the hospital, things are so serious. Not that we don't joke around with each other. Or have a good time, we just oftentimes don't get into that. You know, some patients are quite sick, and we just have to maintain a high level of professionalism. So, no, the TV shows often don't overlap with what actually really goes on.
Well, and the intensity, too. It can't all happen in 1 hour. I mean, you know, one thing after another, so.
Right, exactly. Yeah. I would say, though, that a lot of the teachers I know in the Grey's Anatomy or Scrubs, I don't really watch either one of those, but I know one of the teachers is a real smart aleck. And I can tell you that when I was a resident, I did have teachers who were like that. Who, their job was to embarrass you, to humiliate you, to break you in front of your colleagues. And you had to wither that, and you had to get stronger from that. And I certainly did.
You know, I want to back up a little bit. And I never talked about prescriptions.
Okay.
But it is amazing to me how doctors can keep up with all the prescriptions that are out there, all the drug companies. I have to ask, how is that done?
Sure. Well, in terms of keeping up with what the patients are, let me just talk about that for a minute. Ordinarily, there's, you know, as we were talking about earlier, there's a lot that goes on that patients don't see. When a patient comes in to the hospital for any reason, we need to confirm exactly which medicines they're taking. I'll just kind of start there for a moment. So we do two things. We call their pharmacy and find out which medicines were most recently filled. And then when we actually call the primary care doctor, oftentimes he has the chart open in front of him, the office chart.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll actually go over the medications right then and there as well. And then we also will confirm the medicines with the patients. So we have three levels of checking to see which medicines patients are on. And then we also have a pharmacist in-house all the time, making sure there's no drug interactions. Is this the right dose?
Mm-hmm.
If something seems off at all, the drug does not get administered.
Again, you have all these, what I would say, stopgaps to make sure that are preventative measures.
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
I have seen a couple of mistakes, though. Actually, mm-hmm. I saw a patient getting the wrong medications once when I was a resident. A nurse had gotten her patients mixed up. She had two patients in the same room, which you don't see anymore.
Absolutely.
Partly for safety.
Right, right.
And she had their wristbands. Well, we didn't have a wristband program yet, so she administered the wrong patients to each of the, the wrong medicines to each of the patients. So the roommates got each other's medications.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, but luckily there was no harm, you know, and it was explained to the patient, hey, we made a mistake. This is what happened. We watched the patients, you know, an extra few hours more closely, and nothing happened. But I have seen that.
Now, as a hospitalist, you are involved in, obviously, people who are very sick, if that's why they're in the hospital. And I imagine you've had some very tense situations, also families that are just very stressed out. How do you handle those situations, and what kind of experiences have you had in that degree?
Sure. Well, I always like to start with the extremes. of when I've seen the most tense family members. I've had to break up two fights in my 3 years at Advocate Condell. I actually had to get in between patients or patients' family members.
Well, I should see where that can happen.
Yeah, definitely. Well, one fight actually came out into the hallway. I was walking down a hallway, and two people were struggling with each other and had fallen from the patient's room out into the hallway and were actually rolling around, wrestling one another about a very sick relative that they had in the end-of-life care and so on.
Oh, my.
And I had to get in. Unfortunately, I didn't have time to pick up a phone and call security. I just had to, I mean, you've seen me. I'm not a small guy, but, I'm also, I can break up a phone. So. And then there was another screaming match where I had to run into a room and push two people. A patient and their son were fighting, and I had to separate them with my arms.
Have you had situations, again, I guess I'm relying on films and movies, but where you've had to come and talk to a family member about a terminal situation or something to that degree?
Of course.
I can't imagine doing that.
All the time. Absolutely all the time.
When you say all the time, are you saying once a week, every couple of days? Or?
Yeah, probably once a week. We have to explain, hey, listen, your mom or your dad or your son has a terminal illness. In fact, one case I saw in the last 6 months was a 21-year-old gentleman who had one of the more aggressive bladder cancers I'd ever seen in my career. It actually spread to his eye. I've never seen a cancer do that before. And unfortunately, the cancer actually grew while he was in the hospital over a three-week period. And finally, the couple days before he passed away, I came in and I sat down next to him and I said, I know you're young. I know you have your whole life in front of you, but we're not going to be able to beat this.
Gosh almighty.
And I said that with his mom in the room and the rest of his brothers and sisters. And on the day he died, I knew he was about to die, and he was still very much awake and very much with it. And I took him by the hand and I said, this is your last day.
Oh, my gosh.
This is your last day, so allow me, please allow me to make you comfortable. Let me give you some pain medicines, anti-nausea, anxiety medicines. Let me ease this situation. And he finally accepted it up to that point and said, okay, doctor, do what you need to do. And he died a couple of hours after that encounter.
How do you learn to handle those kinds of situations? I can't imagine. I mean, is that just from experience, or is there actually some sort of class where they talk about empathy, compassion, sensitivity, things like that?
Well, there is a class, actually. Every medical student must take it, and they also have some training in residency. But medical school, you take a semester-long behavioral health type of class where you learn about how to deal with sick patients, tense families, medical errors, things like that, where you learn how to deal with that. But it's not really until residency where you learn to put it into practice. Medical school is not learning to practice. Medical school is learning a foundation of basic science and all the different illnesses, how to diagnose them, and so on. Residency is where you learn to deal with people and their social issues and their family dynamic issues.
Back to that behavior class, do you do a lot of role-playing in there? Is that how that would work?
Oh, of course. Okay. Absolutely, yeah. In fact, we all are exposed to different situations. You have to tell the patient this. You have to tell the family this. This is their reaction. What are you going to do? Things like that. And we're actually recorded and graded on how we do.
This is terrific to know. That's great.
Oh, it's absolutely fantastic. It certainly prepared me. But
like you said, that was just a class. I think you were going to make a point here about residency.
Yeah, right. Well, I can tell you that I want to tell you about my worst day as a doctor, because this is really where I learned to prepare for these types of just awful, dreadful moments. Was Easter Sunday of my final year of residency. I was spending one of my last nights in the intensive care unit as the on-call doctor. And sure enough, at 1:30 in the morning, I get a phone call from the emergency room saying we have a very, very sick elderly lady from Canada. Well, living in Massachusetts, I was only 6 hours from New Brunswick, Canada or so. An elderly couple had decided to take a bus tour of the East Coast down to Myrtle Beach and then back. When they got down to Myrtle Beach, the elderly gentleman's wife became very ill. She actually got admitted to a hospital. They found a blood clot in her heart. She was in kidney failure. She had multiple things going on. But the bus tour needed to resume. So she left the hospital, unfortunately, against medical advice, and got back on the bus.
Oh, my.
And came back up the East Coast. And by the time they got to Massachusetts, where I was the on-call doctor, she had become completely unresponsive. So the bus driver stopped the bus in front of the emergency room and carried her into the emergency room and said, I have a sick lady. By the way, I can't stay. I'm in the middle of a bus tour. I can't stick around to see how she does. So he dropped her and her husband off in the emergency room and then took off for New Brunswick. Well, the emergency room doctor called me and said, this patient's critically ill. She's essentially unresponsive, and she has a blood clot in her heart, and she has kidney failure and all these various things. By the time she got up to me, she could at least speak to me. And her husband was very old and very hard of hearing, so it was a challenge trying to communicate with them both. I had to cut my hands over my mouth to speak to them. Mm-hmm. They were so hard of hearing, which made it even more difficult because of the seriousness and complicatedness, for lack of a better word, of her case. So as the morning progressed, I realized that I was going to need multiple consultants. I brought in multiple doctors over the course of the wee hours of the morning. I also knew she was going to need an IV line, so I put in one of those central lines we were talking about earlier in her neck.
A PICC line is what you're...
No, it's a line in her internal jugular.
Okay.
A PICC
okay.
line is in the arm, internal jugular
That's right.
is in the
okay.
neck.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I started... I put a sterile drape over her head, and we were talking about her being from Canada and so on, because I thought that was interesting. And as I began asking her questions, she began to not respond to me anymore. So I quickly attached the line to her neck and sewed it down so it wouldn't move, and I peeled the sterile cover off of her face, and her pupils were massively dilated, and she was no longer breathing. So I immediately started CPR. I was the only one around because it's by this point it's 3 or 3:30 in the morning. I'm exhausted, completely stressed out. I've been in this patient's room for 2 hours already, and now she's not breathing and her heart has stopped. So I quickly begin CPR. There's no one else around. This is in the days before the code button, which is a blue. If you ever are in the hospital, you'll see a blue button above your bed, and that's so if someone's in the room with you by themselves and something happens, they just punch it and people will come running.
Code blue. Yeah.
Code blue, right. So as I was doing CPR, I was also screaming for help at the same time for people to come in and give me the equipment I needed. So we got the person intubated, which is a tube down the trachea so we can breathe for them. I was actually, after about half an hour, able to resuscitate her.
Oh, my.
Yeah, so around 4:35, I've got her resuscitated, but now she's on a ventilator and on various IV medicines. And then trying to explain this to her husband was an extra challenge because he was almost deaf because of his age and so on. So finally, the sunrise came up. And as a resident doctor, the sunrise is almost like hearing the cavalry charge because you know you have help coming.
Yes, yes, yes.
So definitely a sunrise was a good thing. So my colleagues began to come in, and the patient had a code blue again right at the beginning of when we were going to do rounds. So again, I did CPR. I was covered in blood and in sweat and spit.
This is hours now,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, this is hours, yes. This is about 5 to 6 hours I've been in the same room. I haven't gone to the bathroom. I haven't eaten. I haven't drank water. Nothing. I'm absolutely covered in sweat doing CPR on this lady. I said to myself, I will not let this patient die. I will not let her die. And so I did CPR for another 45 minutes, and finally the attending physician got there, and he recommended a couple other treatments, but essentially I'd done everything that I possibly could, but the patient still unfortunately died around 8:30 or 9.
Oh my gosh, what an experience.
Yeah, so I basically, I sat up against the wall, I slid down the wall with my back, and I sat on my rear end in the corner of the room and just cried.
Oh, I tell you, you've had some incredible experiences, and you said 5 or 6 hours just standing working on this,
this
poor woman.
At least. And that doesn't include the time on the phone with other consultants. I consulted a kidney doctor, a heart doctor, a lung doctor, a neurologist. I consulted multiple doctors. And I'm also still responsible for the other patients in the intensive care unit. So the nurses would come in and talk to me about other things that were going on inside the intensive care unit. So,
well, I imagine now those kinds of experiences you're probably not going to get, are you? Since you're a hospitalist, you're going to have that collaborative group of people around you.
Right. Oh, exactly. Mm-hmm. But the nice thing about Condell, where I'm, you know, my home is we have an intensive care unit doctor there 24 hours.
Oh, that's how that works. The trauma unit. So
Yeah. So that really helps having an ICU doctor there. So when my patients do become critically ill, I actually have a board-certified critical care doctor helping me to take care of someone who's now getting beyond my scope as a general internal.
So different than when you were resident.
And, very different.
Yeah, I tell you, I'm still stuck with the fact that at least once a week you're talking to somebody who's terminal. I don't know how you do it. I really don't.
Right. And in fact, periodically, I'll even call my wife and say, you know, I don't divulge any details, but I'll tell her, I'll say, you know, I'm having a hard time because I have to tell someone that they have a cancer. They don't know yet, and I'm the first one to know. One time I did that, I felt awful. About 3 years ago, a young lady, she was 42, but unfortunately she had been smoking since she was about 15. I'm not trying to scare the smokers out there, but it is something that I like to tell. And unfortunately, she got lung cancer, mm-hmm. and it was widely metastatic. Metastatic means widely spread.
Right.
And it had gone to her brain, unfortunately, and she didn't live much longer, and she was only 42 and had young children and so on. That was hard for me. I wrapped my arm around the husband because she was being transferred to a different part of the hospital, and I said, your wife has metastatic lung cancer. I actually called her primary care doctor, and I said, can you please come in? This is one of only the few times ever in the last 6 years of being a hospitalist I've called the primary and asked them to come in to see the patient.
You know, I appreciate you sharing this because this is a side that we often don't get from doctors, and we see them kind of on Mount Olympus, and everything's fine, it's all going to be fine, but you're seeing kind of the behind the scenes and the incredible stress that you go through, and the emotional stress, too. You know, carrying that weight, but, you know, very commendable. You know, also what we're seeing more and more, too, is the political tension that's in the air as well.
Absolutely.
With Obamacare, national health care. You know, just I think we have to at least touch it on
sure.
it before we move on. But
sure.
What are your thoughts as a doctor? How do you look at national health care, Obamacare?
Absolutely.
Like other countries in Europe have, Sweden and you know,
sure.
Denmark and stuff.
Absolutely. Well, I think we do periodically get asked this by patients, so what do you guys think of Obamacare?
It's interesting, yeah.
Yeah, sure. Well, what I would say is first and foremost is Obamacare is here. It is the law.
Right.
It passed the Congress. It has the president's signature, and the Supreme Court approved it. It is the law. There's really no more debate about that. What it's attempting to do is to get more people insured.
Mm-hmm.
So hospitals and doctors and clinics and physical therapists or labs are getting at least some kind of payment instead of zilch. But at the same time, patients have some – is giving the patient some peace that they're not coming to a doctor and the doctor is just eating it or writing it off.
Because mm-hmm.
some patients do feel quite bad about that. They almost sweat blood about it, saying, I need to see the doctor, but I can't pay him. It's not fair.
Right.
I can't expect him or her to work for free. So I have heard it the other way. It's just, how do you get there? How are you getting to that point where people can have insurance, where you don't have to worry about pre-existing conditions and things like that?
Mm-hmm.
It's how you get there is where the weeping and gnashing of teeth is in between the members of both political parties and so on. But I think it's a good attempt. It's just, how are we going to get there?
Right.
That's
right.
What concerns me.
And really, you're more concerned about the patient care anyway. There's not a lot you can do about it to begin with, so.
Correct. There's nothing I can really do about it other than do my job to the best of my ability. My concerns for the patients are waiting time, especially if you need an elective surgery like a gallbladder, you need an MRI of your low back or something. How long are you going to have to wait? That's where I'm most concerned about.
Right,
I'm
right.
not concerned about me in any way.
Right. Now, as a doctor, you like to take care of yourself.
I do.
And I think we mentioned earlier in the program, you have competed in bodybuilding contests.
I did, yeah.
And I think you were in the all-natural bodybuilding contest. I'm kind of curious about the all-natural.
Sure. Well, let me.
Aren't they all-natural?
No.
I don't know what that exactly means.
Yeah, sure. Well, I'll tell you. So when I was chief resident, you know, like I said, that was more of an administrative year. There wasn't as much patient care going on for me outside of periodically rounding with the residents and teaching them physical examination skills or how to approach tense situations. The other part of it was I had all my weekends free, I had my nights free, I had my holidays off, which is very different now being a full-time doctor, but I walked into a gym because I was getting kind of to the heifer stage, if you will, and some of my patients said, so doctor, I see you're short of breath when you come up the steps. Are you going to tell me to lose weight? And I said, well, yeah. So I went to a gym. I went to a local Gold's Gym in Massachusetts, and I walked in and I talked to a gentleman, and I started working out. I mean, we're talking like basics. I was doing push-ups and sit-ups. I was just learning how to work out. And one of the trainers walked up to me and said, well, you know, you're kind of a decent-sized guy. Have you ever thought about bodybuilding before? And most of my life, I was a runner, and I never thought about weightlifting. So I said, well, I'll give it a try. So unfortunately, though, the bodybuilding competition was only 2 months away. So I had
2 months you had to build up.
Well, I didn't even get a chance to build up, actually. I just had to start getting into shape and start losing weights to show how the muscles would look.
Okay.
So when you're preparing for one of these bodybuilding shows, you build up over time, months to a year. And then you do what's called cutting, where you gradually reduce your calories from carbohydrates and fats in particular, and to show how your muscle will look.
Mm.
You know, because it's kind of a vain sport almost. So,
okay.
So I had to lose, I lost 30 pounds in 8 weeks to get.
That doesn't sound real healthy, Doctor.
Yeah, no, it didn't feel very healthy either, especially what I had to eat. I was in a bad mood for a whole month. But I looked good, though. I was tan because I was tanning almost every day.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I could see my abs. the girls liked me.
What does all natural mean, though?
All natural means you're not taking any banned substances like anabolic steroids, human growth hormone. There are other drugs people take to look a certain way. For example, Lasix, which is a diuretic, to get any extra water weight out of them to make the muscles look sharp and so on. So because it was an all-natural, they needed to prove that all the competitors were on the same playing field together. So they took our urine a few weeks prior to the actual competition, and we also had to get a polygraph test.
That's interesting.
Yeah, which was...
Lie detector.
And then if you won, you were urine tested and polygraphed again right then and there at the actual show.
A little different than cycling, I guess.
Just to make sure. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, very different. Yes, very different. So that's what it means to be all natural. So, oddly enough, I was actually the tallest guy there. I'm about 6'2" or so, and most of the guys were 5'8", 5'9". So I towered over them while I was there, but... I didn't do that well because I only had 8 weeks.
Well, 8 weeks sounds incredible. Yeah. Now, do you still do that? Do you still lift then? And,
I still do periodically lift weights. I like
are these free weights we're talking? Or?
Oh, yes, definitely.
Okay.
Yeah, definitely.
So that's the way to do it if you're going to bodybuild, free weights.
Oh, I think so. And actually, my wife is kind enough to train with me. Her name is Michelle, by the way, my wife. Yeah, she also likes to go to the gym. She's a gym nut, and she's my sweetheart, by the way. And I just want to say hi to her. If that's
absolutely.
Okay. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Hi, sweetie. Anyway, so she sometimes will come to the gym with me, and she's a pretty strong girl, and she can spot me at various times lifting the weights, which is kind of nice.
So you don't use any machines at all? It's all free weights?
The only time I use machines is when the gym is so busy that the free weights just aren't available, and then I will use machines.
Real quick before we break, why not machines? They just don't give you the mass that you'd want?
Right. Well, the machines, I think, are more for endurance, so you do higher repetitions to build endurance.
Right,
but when you actually have
But you can add more weight, can't you?
You could, but the problem is when you have a dumbbell or a barbell on your hand, you don't want to drop it on yourself, so you have muscles to go with balancing.
Gotcha.
The weight that are lost when you're using a machine, whether you're talking upper body or lower body. And I do have a quick funny gym story, if I can quickly share
it. Yeah, go ahead.
So before I was dating my wife, I went to this gym, and there was a girl up on the cardio deck. She was running on a treadmill, and I thought she was kind of cute, and I thought I would show off. So I was doing what's called a back extension, where you lay facing the ground, and you're about 2 feet off the ground, and you bend forward at the waist, and you come back up to strengthen your lower back. And I thought, well, I'm going to show off. So I grabbed a medicine ball, saying, oh, I'm going to show her how strong I am. You know, so I bent down and then tried to come back up, you know, with the medicine ball. And unfortunately, on the way down, I lost my grip on the ball. And as I was coming down, the ball bounced and hit me in the nose. And I actually had a bloody nose.
Oh, my.
So I got up from the thing and rushed into the bathroom to put paper in my nose.
So much for showing off, right?
Yeah, no, that didn't work out too well.
But you're still, sounds like you're very active in it, but no longer competing, obviously, because of the...
Right, yeah, as a full-time doctor and a husband and a homeowner and so on, yeah, it doesn't leave a lot of time for that. But if I could squeeze it in one more time, that would be great.
I tell you what, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back with Dr. Medley right after this. And we're talking to Dr. Medley. Boy, the time just goes so quickly, but I sure want to ask you another question or two before we have to say goodbye.
Sure.
What happens when, or I should say, when people you meet, how do they react when you say, I'm a doctor? Do you find that kind of interesting?
Sure. Well, I usually get a pretty obvious reaction when they're finding out for the first time. If you've ever watched the show The Tudors about King Henry VIII, how they bow and go, Majesty, that's what it's like. Some people...
That didn't happen in this radio studio.
Yeah.
I am the king here. No, I'm just kidding.
Exactly.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
Yeah, yeah. No, so it's usually a form of reverence. Oh, wow, that's great. Oddly enough, people in the gift shop at the hospital when I'm buying a soda or something, I've had two people come up to me in the last month and shake my hand. I had someone pat me on the back and say, thank you so much for what you're doing for our community. And don't even know who I am or what kind
right.
of doctor I am.
That's got to be very satisfying.
Oh, of course, of course. And I'm very, you know, I'm very honored, you know, and I tell them, of course, this is I love to do this. This is what I love to do. But oftentimes people, the other assumption they make is that I'm filthy, stinking rich.
I tell you, what is the most satisfying thing about your job, would you say?
Seeing people get better. Mm. That's what I like.
Simply put.
Yeah. Seeing people get better. You know, you got better. You look great.
Well, I couldn't look worse when I met you there.
Yeah,
you
no,
know?
Yeah, no, I know. Yeah, no, seeing people get better, that's really the most rewarding thing for me.
You know, I wish we had more time. It just went so fast. I can't thank you enough for coming in. It's just been just a lot of fun. And thank you again for, you know, sharing all the stories. Thanks so much.
Oh, absolutely. Thanks so much, Jim.
Really, really appreciate it. So we'll say goodbye to Dr. Medley, but if you would like to contact him, simply go to the website, Best Practice Inpatient Care, and you can contact Dr. Brian Medley. Thank you for tuning in. I hope to drop by again next week at 11 a.m. for another edition of Word of Mouth.